All right, everybody, you're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Go Wild. Go Wild is one of the fastest growing social media applications for the outdoor enthusiast. Be sure to download it wherever you download your podcasts and check it out with if you have any questions on timetogowild.com. Now, day two and day three, a lot of walking around, a lot more products to look at. Overall, really quick, the 2019 ATA show is in the books. What did you think?
Well, for me, as my first time there,
yeah,
I would say that it was definitely a positive experience.
Yeah,
it was fun to just be able to walk around with a lot less bodies than you would normally see at like a typical expo or something that'd be open to the whole public.
Yeah.
So that part of it was really nice. And I definitely met a ton of people that I've exchanged messages with and stuff like that online.
Yeah.
Was able to meet a lot of those people in person.
Right.
So overall, I loved coming to the show.
Yeah. And just to reiterate on kind of what we talked about, what the last podcast that we released, the ATA show day one podcast. One thing I really like about the ATA show is getting to meet the people who have been working in the industry for like 40 years, right? Not necessarily the big giant corporations, like, you know, relative to the industry, like let's say Rage Broadheads has only been around for a little while, right? I mean, maybe 10 years, but still, compared to some of these other companies that have, you know, like we're born into the archery, the bow hunting industry. It's awesome to see those people, shake their hands, get a little history with some of their products, and I don't know, as well as some of the mom and pop shops that are there as well. So I really like looking into the smaller companies, the smaller brands, and giving them some love as well, because you never know. Like we talked about the last time, that Total Peep company, a lot of people would have walked right by them.
Yeah.
So today, Garrett, I was swamped with meetings, and I had the ability to look at a couple cool products as well. But you've highlighted five that you're going to talk about, and I think I'm going to squirt in a couple as well. So why don't we just get right into it and talk about the first company that kind of stuck out to you?
Yeah, so there's a company called Atomic Rods.
Okay.
They're known for stabilizers, but they had a new product that was not actually a stabilizer here at the show. That's, I just checked, it's not on their website either.
Yeah.
But it was really unique for target archers, but also just archers in general.
Yeah.
Basically what they have is they have a tool that allows you to take a small sensor, attach it to the riser of your bow. They have an integrated app that goes with this. You draw your bow back, and you hold your bow for, I think it's 7 or 10 seconds or something like that.
Yeah.
And then the light goes off. You know, you can let down or shoot or whatever. It maps, based on that sensor, what your pin float is doing.
Okay.
And it displays it on a graph.
Okay.
Right, so then you're able to plug in all of your specs, draw weight, draw length, rear stabilizer length, weight, front bar weight, length, all those different variables.
Yeah.
You can record all that. Then you can do the same thing with a new setup.
Yep.
Tweak some more things. Do the same thing. Eventually you get a graph with like up to 4 different pin float patterns overlaid on top of one another. And then there's an algorithm that can take all that data, so you're not just looking at the stuff that might look similar, and it ranks, okay, these were your best pin float patterns.
Okay.
And then so you take your top one. Okay, now I know that this is the best. Now I can try tweaking some other stuff. So eventually you're taking maybe a pin float that looks like, you know, kind of a tight pattern, but you get maybe some waves every now and then or something. You're able to really quickly fine-tune and get kind of the best balance and pattern for setting up your bow so that you're able to hold the steadiest.
Okay.
And you can do that without that kind of technology, but it takes a lot of range time to be able to figure that out.
Right. So what – this is a laser attachment?
It's not a laser. It's just basically a sensor, a motion sensor. It's. I've been imagining it's like an accelerometer type of thing.
Okay. So it documents any little movement.
Yeah.
Okay.
Microscopic movements it's picking up on. And there's different sensitivity levels. They were saying that like guys who are just starting off in archery, like it was not, or it was too sensitive for them, but then like not sensitive enough for the guys who were like pros.
Yeah.
So they've added different like sensitivity levels that you can choose.
Awesome. That seems like something that I would be interested in using in the off season, just for the pure fact of I self admit don't have the greatest form when it comes to archery. Right. I'm kind of a grip it and rip it kind of guy. And even though I do practice a lot, I don't practice throughout the year like I should, but practicing, you know, all through the summer into the, you know, late spring in through the summer, getting ready for, you know, an elk hunt or whatnot. I can see how this would be cool just to practice in the house during the winter months.
Yeah. You don't have to be outside to use it.
Right. Right.
And I can see it, especially, I mean, like, it's not going to teach you how to shoot with good form.
Right.
But if you can learn to shoot with good form, it's a great refinement tool.
Yes. Yeah, I agree.
It wasn't super cheap. I think it was going to be like $300.
Yeah.
So definitely not something that's going to be for everybody, but yeah, definitely a big time saver.
You would have to be very serious about archery to purchase something like that, I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I do that kind of stuff in the summer too. And it's like, how many nights do I spend out on the range testing one more ounce of weight on the front bar?
Yeah.
Or moving the rear bar out 10 degrees. And then you're just kind of going out subjectively off your memory. Did that pin float seem better or worse than what I tried just a second ago? And that takes all the guesswork out of it. And it just gives you an actual number. It gives you a ranking based on that algorithm.
So does the output of that data then allow you to, does it tell you where you need to put the weight on the stabilizer?
No, it just gives you what you're able to do with whatever setup you have, and allows you to take notes on what that setup was.
Okay.
So then you can store that and basically just go from there. So you have to give it the input. It can't predict based on what you've already done what you should do next.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, that's very interesting. And I feel like with the smartphone and the definite increase in technology, there's a lot more of that kind of stuff out here. Right. And I think I saw a target today that automatically tells you how you need to adjust after shooting X number of arrows. I didn't catch the brand, but you shoot, there's a target, and then it patterns what you shoot. And then it tells you how to adjust your sight. So, yeah, definitely very interesting. Anything else on that product? Or that company?
That was the main thing. I didn't really look too closely into their stabilizer stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of companies are making stabilizers.
Right. What was the name of that company again?
Atomic Rods.
Atomic Rods. Okay. All right. What is the next one?
Next one I had was Sitka.
Sitka, yes. That was one of mine as well. And for anyone in the Midwest who walks in the timber, or for the most part, it's in the CRP or like the 10 yards in between a field edge and the timber, it's when, where it's the thickest, where the sunlight can hit the most. And there's those damn burrs that just stick all over your clothes. And so what Sitka's done is they've taken the little bottom part of their jacket and certain parts, I would say, from the bottom of the pants to somewhere around the knee, is a new material, right?
Yeah, they've taken that high pile burr off of some of the key areas where burrs would normally gather.
Yeah.
They took some out of the inside of the arm, too, on both arms. So, like, a small patch on your release arm elbow.
Yeah.
And then your entire draw length arm. So, if you're right-handed, you're drawing back. This entire sleeve, your left arm sleeve is totally flat.
Yep.
You don't have that high pile where the string can get in the way. And then you don't have all that material crunching up on the inside crease of your elbow. And they do make that left and right handed, that jacket, that new Fanatic.
Wow. I mean, that's crazy. So that's how serious Sitka is about their gear, that they make a jacket for someone who's left or right handed.
And it's got a magnetic closure for the, so you got that side zipper that goes kind of up at an angle.
Yep.
You can take that extra flap, and when you fold it away, it magnetically attaches to the shoulder. So it stays out of the way of your,
I didn't catch
your
that.
String.
I didn't catch that.
I asked the guy a lot of questions.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's what you do. But, yeah, that's crazy. I think – so the real test, right, is – what do they call that? Beggar's lice or it's that thin strip with, like,
oh, yeah.
That stuff. Like, when that sticks on you, I mean, it would stick on these pants. It sticks on jeans. So I really, that's the worst of it. I really wonder if that change will actually work on that stuff.
I mean, I would think it might still stick, but it might be easier to get off.
Get off.
Yeah. You might just, you know, pat down your pants or whatever. Yep. It might be easy to get that to come out.
Yeah. Because of my current Sitka system, like I used to take time to pull all of them off. And if it's in the front and I'm in the tree stand while I'm waiting for deer to come by, I'll sit there and pick them off. But not when, if it's a ton of them, they're on there. Yeah. I'm not going to take the time to go in and pick off every single one of those, like 1/8 of my fingernail size burrs. Yeah. Man, it's annoying. So,
and I mean, I never used Sitka in the past.
Yeah.
One of the reasons was because of that high pile fleece.
Yeah. Yeah. So do you think this is something that from a Sitka, you know, from that change is something that makes you look at that brand now or not?
Yeah, it's definitely a lot more attractive of an option. I mean, realistically, like the clothes I have now are fine. They would continue to be fine for several years. But if I wanted to try that system out and play around with it, yeah, that's a lot more appealing than it was last year.
Yeah, absolutely. And kind of sticking on to clothing once, and this is, I find this interesting because there's a company called Element Camo. Did you get around to see them?
I saw some of their garments. I saw their booth. We were looking in that one side room. They had some garments there, but I didn't really go too in depth.
Right. What I like about Element Camo is that they've taken a huge jump in quality and technical, like the technicalness. Is that a word? Technicalness, whatever, of their of their gear from their Gen 1 series to their Gen 2 series. They took a huge step, and because of that, I did an interview on this podcast with them. The owner sent me some of their stuff. I looked at it and I was just like, I wore it a little bit. Didn't really get too into it. I didn't think it performed as well. However, they've made some huge strides in their development, and it makes me want to take another look at that brand again.
Is it more fit and finish things that they've improved or materials?
Fit, finish, and materials, right? So they have a fleece insert. It just overall looks better. You can tell just by looking at the garment itself that it's really well built. And so that's definitely something that I'm going to take a look at, because especially from a tree stand standpoint, right? Probably not for my Western hunts. Yeah. I'm still going to be probably a merino base layer, you know, Sitka mountain jacket, mountain pants type guy. But with a tree stand, you know, tree stand application, instead of maybe having to buy the new Fanatic system or the new Fanatic jacket or pants or whatever, going with something off and just keeping my elk base layers and some of the others and mix and match. I think that would it could be a good option for people. So I really like to see, especially like what Sitka does, right? They take their customer reviews very seriously and they adapt their products to that, just like their Fanatic system. And I think this Element Camo company did the same thing, and they're direct to consumer and, you know, obviously a little cheaper than Sitka, but I like it when a company makes those changes and you see real results in their Gen 2, whether it's gear or it's clothing. I really like that. So
yeah, definitely.
Yeah. All right. What's next?
Next, I have T-Bird Archery.
Okay.
Makes a modular arrow saw.
Okay.
So arrow saws have always been kind of one of those things where it's like, most of the time, if you don't have an arrow saw, they're kind of expensive. You go to the archery shop. If you didn't buy the arrows there, you got to pay X number of dollars for them to get them cut to length. Yeah. And then they're not always square. They don't always take the time to square them for you.
Yeah.
This guy has an arrow saw that's designed to be able to, you could use it in the shop, but it's also designed so that the everyday guy could be able to use one of these in his garage.
Yep.
instead of just having one huge tray that's just one piece,
yeah,
you can take it into pieces and it comes in a smaller package. So you can, when you're not using it, put it back in its case, store it somewhere, and then be able to, when you want to cut a dozen arrows or whatever, lay the thing back out, lock it all together. And he had a couple of components that were all integrated into the same system that I thought was unique. Usually you get an arrow saw, it's just an arrow saw.
Right.
He had, you could plug in basically like a vac, a shop vac.
Yep.
So you're sucking out all that carbon dust.
Yep.
The saw is on the same kind of rotor as like a arrow squaring device.
Okay.
So normally like an arrow squaring device, you got a small, like a little grit, like a carbide grit finish that kind of sands that carbon. Yep. Since it's rotating on kind of that same disc, you can set your length, take your arrow, put it in that hard stop, cut the arrow to length, move it over like an inch, rest it on an arrow spinner, and then just slowly move it in and just touch it up against that rotating disc that has that grid on it, and that squares your arrow in like a fraction of a second.
Yeah.
Then you take it off and you're done. You got an arrow spinner right there integrated in the machine, so it's like multiple tools in one.
Nice. Do you build your own arrows?
Yeah.
Yeah. See, I don't. And it's something that I want to learn how to do.
And the only thing that I have been shorting myself on is an arrow saw.
Yeah.
Whenever, it's always been one of those things. It's like the last, I can do most stuff in my garage, but cutting the arrows to length is one of those last things that I've still driven to the pro shop to be able to do.
Right.
But that might be something that I go ahead and get.
What's that cost?
It's like $160, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So that's not bad.
Yeah.
When you think about it, because whenever I was in a bow shop watching it, it just seemed like it was a much bigger machine than how big was this thing, you think?
Lengthwise longer than what you need for an arrow. The tray was probably 6-8 inches wide.
Yep.
The machine itself was probably, I don't know, what'd you call this, like the size of a cantaloupe?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Nice. All right. So anything else with that company? Or is that the
made? Pretty much, that was their main thing.
Okay. And the name of that again?
T-Bird Archery.
T-Bird Archery. All right. Okay. What is next?
So you know how the last podcast I said I wanted to look a lot more at like cell cams?
Cell cams, yes. Yep.
So there's definitely a lot of companies that had cell cams available. You know, companies that you were familiar with like SpyPoint.
Yep. Spartan.
Right. So some of these companies that have already had cameras out, I saw Moultrie made like a $180 one that they were presenting.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So that's like one end of the spectrum is like cell cams are starting to get cheaper.
Right.
The other end of the spectrum is cell cameras that are going higher in quality. So same type of thing that like Lone Wolf Customs is doing with like trying to get just like the best system. They don't care how much it costs.
Yeah.
Guys are trying to do that with the cell cameras too.
Right.
So there's one company I talked to called Intelligent Surveillance Corp.
Okay.
Basically like they're a lot of their business is based on making security cameras for the US government.
Really?
They got cameras on the border walls. They have their system. And I talked with their tech guy for like a half an hour. So like I'm going to upload a video on it, but the video that I upload is like a fraction of all the detail that we went into.
Right.
So we really nerded out about like the sensor and the processor and the lens and all that stuff that they're using. Basically it's like top quality components. They're using like one of the biggest Sony sensors, like up to date that you can get. They're using a higher resolution lens. They're using a signal processor that can take a large amount of data from that sensor and actually process it in a video codec. Like they can film 4K video with this camera.
Wow.
And it's doing it in an H.265 codec, which is more efficient than what is usually on the market now. So you're getting higher quality video with a lower file size.
So it's almost like a DSLR camera.
It's essentially, that's how they kind of told it. It's like the technology of like a DSLR in a trail camera.
Wow.
So he was showing me pictures too, like pictures and videos of him like walking through a creek half hour after sunset.
Yeah.
And the sensor quality, the lens, the ISO.
Right.
It's like the automatic gain, the digital gain that they're able to add in. It looked like it was still half hour before sunset.
Yeah.
Just with the amount of light that was there. So normally trail cameras at that time of day, they're kicking on IR already. Sometimes you get that weird intermediate phase where it's like kind of a whitish grayish picture.
Or it's like, or the sun's coming up and it hasn't switched back to daylight and it's really dark. Yeah.
Yeah. So image quality looked fantastic. The other thing because like there's no visible antennas. So I saw some trail cameras that were cellular that had like 2-foot-long antennas sticking out the top of them today.
Yep.
And the guy was basically telling me, he's like, if you see a trail camera that has 2 antennas out of the top, he's like, they don't know what they're doing. Yep. He basically just came right out and said that. He's like, the second antenna does, I can't remember exactly what he told me in detail, but he's like, it's not necessary. And in addition, a lot of it depends on how the thing is tuned.
Right.
So they're saying internally, like an iPhone has like a couple different embedded. So it's like saying like, how can, with a cell cam, how come you sometimes will see better reception on your phone than the camera that has the antenna?
Yeah.
And he's saying like, well, theirs, they have 4 internal antennas that are tuned to multiple different like frequencies or modes of connectivity basically.
Right.
So it's not specific to Verizon. It's not specific to AT&T. You can choose depending on where you're at. Maybe your location does better AT&T.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you got bad weather and all of a sudden Verizon is better. You can change that from the app inside your house.
Really?
Yeah.
So it lets you choose the strongest signal.
Yeah.
So now you talked to me about this already a little bit. So from a retail standpoint, what are we talking about here?
Expensive.
Yeah.
Like $600, $650, somewhere in that range for their lower end model.
Okay. Now that probably compares somewhere. It's got to compare somewhere to the Reconyx, right?
Yeah.
I didn't even stop at the Reconyx booth this year, but I mean, in the past, I don't even want to guess, but I thought they were coming out with, they had trail cameras in the $1,000 mark.
Really?
$800, somewhere around there. But like, that was early on when when they were like one of the first with cell technology. But now, like you said, as more companies come out with cell cameras, that price of a cell camera on average, depending on what it can do and what the specs are on it, is going down. Right.
Right. Right. Yeah. And their more expensive model.
Right.
Their like tier 2 model was like $900-something.
Okay.
And what that one did that the less expensive one didn't do was it has more of an algorithm built into it that can allow you to only send certain things. So it can use artificial intelligence to be able to tell if it's a picture that has a deer in it, or if it has a turkey in it or whatever, and only send you those pictures and not send you the pictures of a squirrel going by, not send you pictures of, you know, I brought up like, oh, so you're not going to get pictures of branches swinging past. He's like, that shouldn't happen anyway.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
He's like, that's a tuning issue if you got that going on.
Yeah. Or grass blowing in the wind.
Yeah. I've had trail cameras where they fill up in like 2 days.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Set them in the wrong spot.
Absolutely. I have, in regards to this cell camera, what was like the battery situation with it?
It had 8 AA batteries.
Yep.
That basically you slide it in from the bottom, it looked like.
Okay. Does it look like a standard trail camera?
Kind of. I'd say it looks less hunting-ish.
Yeah.
Like normally you got the, you know, kind of the cool 3D, you know, molded housing and the camo. Like it was pretty, just like a basic rectangular block.
Yeah.
With like the lens and the sensor.
Gotcha.
And then they had, looked like a rubberized like housing that you could slide over the top.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And their third tier model, not available for consumers.
Really? So it's
tied into like
the government contracts.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow. That's nuts. And the government probably just pays whatever they want for price, you know, if they have a government contract. So kind of going back on the algorithm, being able to identify and send certain things. I think that's some of the same technology that Deer Lab is using. So as you fill up your card on your trail camera, you insert it into your computer and you start uploading those files to Deer Lab. Well, you can select the Deer Lab will tell what pictures like label pictures. So deer or human or bird or whatever, it'll put a title to whatever's on there. And then you can delete everything that is not a deer.
Right.
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 So that's cool that I have a feeling that it has to be some of the same type of technology.
Yeah, and my SpyPoint app for the cameras that I have from SpyPoint.
Yeah.
They have that too. Like you can click on the buck filter and it's supposed to filter only the buck pictures and stuff. I mean, it's like, it's okay. It's not,
does it work?
It's obviously not going to be, if you're using it in the field, it's probably better.
Yeah.
But like a lot of times when I'm setting cameras up, I'm hanging them up in trees facing down in like wooded areas. So it's like, if you get a picture where like 80% of the deer is covered up by, obstructed by trees and stuff, it's like, it's not going to pick out that little, like, you know, little bit of antler tines.
Right. Right. All right. Anything else with that trail camera? Is there a fourth tier?
I hope not. Talk to aliens.
Yeah. All right. So what's the next one?
Next one I have is FireKnock.
FireKnock.
And they didn't really have anything that was like particularly new this year, but like this is one of those companies that is unique in that there's so much technology packed into what they do that I think a lot of people don't understand it.
And describe what FireKnock is.
Yeah, so I think a lot of people know FireKnock is the company that makes really expensive lighted knocks.
Yep.
That, you know, high precision, they use circuitry and accelerometers to turn the knock on and off.
Yeah.
But beyond that, they have an aero system. And Dorge, the guy who's like behind FireKnock, he comes from the aerospace. I don't know if he has a PhD or what exactly his credentials are, but he came from the aerospace industry. And he is the most OCD guy that I've ever met in regards to aero construction. He understands not only the physics, but he understands manufacturing. He understands process. He's talking about how you have to glue certain things with certain adhesives within certain dates and in a certain way. You got to clean your – like he's
– right.
Like I said, he's the most OCD guy I've probably ever met in regards to aero construction. Right. But their system is – basically designed to, if you use all the components, designed to make the arrow act more efficiently when shot out of the bow.
Okay.
So he was talking about, like, you know, you can have shafts that sit behind your insert inside the arrow.
Yeah.
That will make you have different spine ranges throughout the arrow. That's going to help the arrow dynamically react quicker out of the bow. Same thing on the rear side of the arrow. He was inserting tubes just shy of the knock.
Mm-hmm.
So you're basically, like, if you think of the nodes of the arrow as it flexes like this, it's changing the shape of that diagram as the arrow flexes.
Okay.
So he's saying, like, you know, most of the time 9 yards out in front of the bow, the thing's no longer flexing at all.
Okay.
It's just spinning and going. He's got a lot of components, and I don't want to go into too much detail about what they all are, but...
Is it when I hear system, I hear broadhead, arrow, fletchings, knock.
So his his system would be arrow shaft.
Yep.
He says he has a weave that he thinks is optimized to be able to allow the most consistent dynamic response.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're saying most arrows, the way they're designed, the spine actually... It's not just like a linear, like stiff side, weak side of the arrow. It actually has like a little bit of a curve to it. He was saying that the way his are woven are supposedly straighter, more consistent in that spine.
Yeah.
So he's got the shaft. He's got inserts. And the inserts, he's got titanium. He's got stainless steel. He's got aluminum. I asked him, performance-wise, why would you choose one versus the other? He said mostly it's weight. The aluminum is the lightest.
Gotcha.
Titanium is the midweight. Stainless steel is the heavyweight option. You just choose whatever you want based on what the overall specs of the arrow need to be. Then behind that insert, they have that carbon tube that's adding that stiffness throughout that front range.
Yep.
Another carbon tube at the back that's adding stiffness toward the back end of the arrow. So most of your flex is just occurring in that center part of the arrow. That affects where the nodes are. And the last part of the system, I guess, would be like the knock. A couple other minor things about like both the knock and the insert. He has a way of chamfering the shaft so that instead of just having a squarely cut arrow and the inserts slapped against that square end, his inserts actually have like a wedge, and then he'd be creating like a taper on the the carbon shaft. So one would fit into the other. And then when you have a hard impact, it's, if anything, it's just forcing it to be more concentric.
Yeah.
You don't have issues where all of a sudden, like, with your tolerances, you hit something and maybe your arrow shifts a little bit like that and introduces wobble. Ultimately, though, some of the data that he was telling me about and some of the numbers, with his system, you end up with a really low FOC arrow.
Yeah.
Which I talked to him in great detail about because he's one of the guys that is firmly low FOC.
Yeah.
It seems like with his system, he believes that that's better, but you can't just pick and choose certain things
right.
of the system.
And it seems to be, maybe we're getting out of that right now, but I know last year it was a huge, like, FOC was a hot topic.
Yeah.
In just discussion about arrows.
Yeah. Yeah. And what he was saying was essentially, you know, with your high FOC, right, you got the big head and you're, the less weight you have in the tail end of the arrow when you hit something hard, right, you have less mass moving around side to side to impede penetration. So that's mm-hmm. kind of like one of the big things of why FOC is supposed to give you better penetration. But he is saying the way with his setup works is it's so linear by the time it hits that you're not getting that flex induced as much. So anything that's straight, it doesn't matter where the weight is, it's going straight through. You're not getting that oscillation
yeah.
as much.
Yeah.
So that was kind of his theory behind it and his data. He was saying that when the arrow has a really low FOC like that, it flies flatter, doesn't fly arced where you shoot it up and right, it goes down like this.
Yeah.
He's saying you shoot it and it just kind of levels out, takes a gyroscopic spin and just kind of floats horizontally. So he's saying like at 100 yards, for example, you get, he had a guy shoot like a 400 grain arrow, shot it. And then he took one of his systems at 440 grains. And while as the first arrow was kind of angled down on that target at 100 yards,
mm-hmm.
the other arrow, his arrow system, which was heavier, was 13 inches higher and stuck straight into the target. So he's basically saying by the numbers and the high-speed camera and the setting the chronographs downrange, it's retaining a lot more of that initial velocity coming out of the bow. So whereas a normal arrow, maybe starting at 300,
mm-hmm.
maybe you're at 260 by 80 yards. But with his system, you might still be at 290.
Wow. Wow. Man, I love science. Like, to me, when you were describing that, it made me think of a boat coming out of the water, being tail heavy first, and then coming out and just planing up. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So, I don't know if that's a good comparison, but...
Yeah. To build his system, it's really expensive.
Yeah.
And the other thing he was telling me, too, is, like, tolerances on the vanes...
Right.
Tolerances on the glue that holds the veins together make a big difference, right? Like to have his system, it has to be perfect,
right?
Or else it's not going to work as intended, right?
Yeah. Let's say I bought into what this dude was saying.
Yeah.
How much does it cost for, let's say, like, I don't know, how does he sell them six arrows?
You can buy the components individually. I don't know if you can buy complete systems, but then he trains. He only certifies certain dealers. He won't sell to dealers that don't go through his basically like classroom training because he doesn't want people selling his stuff that don't understand how the system works.
Wow.
Because he thinks it's going to do him a disservice because guys are going to be not doing it correctly and then they're going to have, you know, kind of half-assed results from the system. People are not going to like the system.
Yeah, it makes sense.
So he only sells through certain dealers that have gone through the process of being certified and trained.
Yeah.
But you can buy the components off the website. I've actually bought some of his components in the past to play around with. But yeah, for a normal guy to get a system, I think you'd have to buy through one of his dealers,
mm-hmm.
one of his certified dealers, or be able to piece the stuff together yourself, which is definitely doable. I mean, he sells all the tools to be able to put them together.
Do you have a rough estimate of what something like that would cost?
I don't. I mean, I'm sure like the tools, like the fletching jig and some of the oscillation tools and stuff, they're expensive.
Does that come with the system too?
No.
Okay.
I would say, you know, like the Grizzly Stick arrows I bought last year.
Yeah.
I think they were like, ended up being like, with all the stuff I bought, like $180 for six.
Yeah.
I would bet if you did this whole system, it might be more than that.
Yeah. Okay.
Without putting the numbers together bit by bit.
Yeah. That's some really detailed and You know, like, it's crazy how in the industry you have that. You have something that is so precise, and then there's, you know, other, like, I'll just use Easton because it's the bigger company, that you can go to Walmart and grab six arrows out of a tube, and who knows what the weight, if they're even straight by the time they get there, right. Type, you know. So, yeah, that's pretty interesting. Anything on that?
Interesting sidebar. He was also saying that 3,000 and 6,000 straightness arrows are preferable to the 1,000 straightness. He said the reason for that was if you get a 1,000, it's so close to being straight, it's really hard to predict what it's going to do. Whereas if you've got a 3,000 or a 6,000, it's going to do a certain thing. It's going to have some kind of directionality to it, you know, the way it bends and whatnot.
Right.
And you can index that, right? You can shoot at long range and be able to say, oh, this arrow's always flying to the right, and you can turn your nock and be able to get it to go straight, and then eventually all your arrows are aligned perfectly with one another after you go through that process. But with the 1,000s, it's harder to do that. I feel like some of that stuff's getting really far into the weeds.
Yeah, I feel like as far as accuracy is concerned, right, you have so many different things that come into play, right? And if the arrow is straight, and let's just say the arrow is perfectly straight, there is no curve to it, I would feel that would be, at that point, be a constant in an equation, right? It's something that you don't need to worry about because the arrow is straight. You know, it's always going to do the same. It's a perfect arrow, right?
Well, yeah, but then you also got the spine is a big part of it too, and how the spine aligns on the shaft.
Yeah.
Right. So that arrow could maybe behave more erratically, or it could behave differently from like the rest of the shafts. Like it might be, like you were saying, harder to, like if you had, let's say you have arrows that are all curved. If you curve all those arrows the same way, like, you know, they're probably going to fly pretty similarly.
Yeah. It allows you to tune your setup accordingly.
Right, it makes it easier to match one to the next.
Gotcha.
Whereas if you're starting off so close to perfect, it makes it harder to match one to the other because they're so close. It's maybe hard to tell exactly where the differences are. Yeah. But again, it's like, what does it matter if you're getting good arrow flight? Like ultimately, that's the your accuracy is the main indicator of anything else.
I could see something like that. Yeah. All right. Anything else with that fire knock?
No. They have a lot of, if guys are interested in that, they got a lot of info on their website, a lot of like archery, like arrow 101 and stuff like that.
Gotcha. All right. What else? What else you got for us?
That was the big five that I had chosen to go over.
All right.
There's a lot of other stuff I looked at.
What would be the next one on your list? I think we got time for, we got time for maybe a couple more, one more, maybe two more.
So there's, of the climbing six companies,
yes, I think that's the one I want to talk about.
I think there's a couple of things. Like, I think Lone Wolf had a lot of press about what they did, but they weren't the only people that had climbing stick things that were new or updated.
Right.
Hawk, they made a couple changes to their sticks.
Okay.
So the Hawk Helium sticks, which have been pretty popular sticks.
Right.
What a lot of guys have been doing with those sticks, because they don't like the attachment method, is they've been installing their own DIY Versa buttons to make them like the Lone Wolves.
Yeah.
And then they'll just use a strap to attach it on.
Right.
Hawk has now implemented that into their new sticks.
Right.
That type of button attachment where you can just loop a strap over the top. They also added kind of like a suction cup between one versus the other. So you can take the two sticks and kind of suction cup them together. And then they hold together like that.
So then all you have to do is just pull them apart when you get to wherever you're taking them apart at.
Mm-hmm.
Suction cups.
Yeah. I didn't see them up close. That was one of the booths I didn't
stop by that booth either.
I didn't even see it. There's so many booths in there.
Yeah. That's funny. There are a lot of booths. I think what they were saying is like a half mile from aisle zero to aisle like 5,000, that there's just so many. I mean, there's hundreds and hundreds of booths in there.
I felt like there were certain booths I'd see like eight times a day.
Yeah.
And then there, like at the end of the day, all of a sudden there'd be like something I haven't seen before.
Right.
It's like clearly I'm like taking, without like looping like down each aisle, like I was definitely taking predisposed like my brain was just automatically picking the same route over. I think a lot.
Yeah. So Hawk implemented that new Versa button. Mm-hmm. Now, what about these? Was it injection or rotomolded? Yeah.
Stacked outdoors had injection molded climbing sticks.
Okay.
They were like a glass filled nylon, like a 40% long fiber glass.
Yeah.
And they're one piece, double step. They have really wide step surface to be able to put your boot on.
Yeah.
And then that step is spaced very far from the tree.
Okay.
So overall, very comfortable to stand on. Not going to give you a lot of calf fatigue. They weren't the lightest sticks in the world. I think the stack of four of them was like, 9.5 pounds or somewhere in that range.
Yeah.
They stack perfectly vertically. I think the guy had like 7 sets all just in one big stack. There's no gaps between the sticks. They basically nest like solo cups.
Right? Yeah. So then was there any moving parts at all on those sticks?
No moving parts.
Okay. How did they attach to the tree?
They have basically buttons on the side of the sticks that you would put a strap on. So I asked them if you had to have the strap separate, like the way they stack, like none of the stacks had the straps on it. So I was like, do you have to take those off to be able to stack them? And he's like, no, you can still stack them with the straps on. He's like, a lot of times he'll do it that way and then just use like an extra strap to loop them all four of them together at the end. He's like, but sometimes it could be easier just to have the strap separate and just pull one out as you need it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think last year Millennium came out with a micro stand, like a really small stand. But other than the Lone Wolf, you know, I didn't see real anything. However, I just want to say that like the original Lone Wolf, right? I still see that being able to be used into somebody's system throughout a year, right? That stand.
Oh yeah. Well, yeah. I think they're going to cater to different, like you wouldn't take the new Lone Wolf costume. You wouldn't outfit your property with that.
No, you wouldn't.
Way too expensive.
Yeah.
Right. So I think just price wise, there's still going to be a lot of people who are still going to want to probably stick with the original Lone Wolf or Lone Wolf
tree stands. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Right. Yeah, that's right. So let's see, man, we could sit here and talk for hours about all the companies that were there. And this is just one of those things that to tell all the listeners out there to do your research, because there are companies out there that do things a little bit different, and they may do those things that are just a bit different to what you're really looking for. So take time, do your research, really look into products that you want to buy, whether it's a bow or a trail camera or boots or whatever, and just do your research, because there were hundreds of companies there that sold thousands of different products. And if you're not happy with what you have right now, I'm sure you can find a company that will provide you with what you need. So,
yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
Oh yeah.
Anything else you want to chit chat about? I'm getting hungry again.
We've been talking about this earlier. So we eat so much at night that you end up not being hungry until about 2 p.m.
Yeah.
And then I end up not eating until dinner again.
Right.
So I'm only eating like one meal a day.
Right. Right. Oh, wait. Just to recap then on what you said about Peak Refuel.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
They're coming out with new stuff. So, man, I walked up to the ATA food court, right? And I was looking at their menu, and it was like $10 for things. Just outrageously priced, in my opinion. And it didn't even look good, right? So I hardly even ate there. So I ended up, I was hungry. So I ended up going to the Peak Refuel booth. And I said, listen, man, can you make me a pouch? Do you have any pouches left over? I'm hungry and I don't want to eat this gross ass food. And he's like, hell yeah, dude. So he served me up and I ate some beef and noodles. God, I forget the name of it, but it's like their version of beef stroganoff. And it was freaking delicious. So I went to the Quiet Cat booth with Adam Parr of Transition Wild, and I sat down in the Quiet Cat booth, and I ate I ate some Peak Refuel while, and it was good. So that might be an option for elk hunting this year.
Yeah, I liked it. I bought a whole pack of it when it was on clearance for Black Friday.
So
I got a big case I'm saving for a next trip.
Nice. Yeah. Well, your first ATA show is over. I think this is like my ninth, I want to say. Maybe ninth, because I went for a while and then I backed out of it because I think I had some small kids there, and then now I'm on a roll for a while. But again, I really like coming to this show. I don't know if I'm going to come next year, and I'll tell you why. I think I want to experience another big show like the Western Expo out in Salt Lake City,
yeah,
or something like that, or maybe one of the bigger retail shows like Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, or as the Sportsman's Nation evolves into like the fishing category, I would love to kind of go to that ICAS show in Florida. Yeah. I think that would be pretty cool to go attend as well. So we'll see what happens. More than likely I'll come back, but we'll see. Well, we done?
I think so.
All right.